The ripple effect and impact of COVID-19 is truly bigger than any of us can begin to imagine. Even as the COVID-19 illnesses are taking lives, we still have huge environmental and climate change burdens. Together with the slow, ongoing erosion of the economy, it is a perfect storm and not a very good one. So it begs the question, why are we treating all of this so much in the immediate and disconnected moment more as a consumption problem, providing money for people and businesses to spend to stimulate the economy, which I understand, but no money to invest and to build up our resiliency within a sustainable capacity? Why are we not building our future? Hey, everybody, I'm Gina Murphy-Darling, and this is Impact Earth, Climate Reality. And I encourage you to stay with me to hear from a person who is a world-renowned hybrid. I made that title up for him. He's an internationally recognized and sought-after economist with a rock-solid understanding of how economics and climate science are inextricably bound. And I can tell you all, he has convinced me. So please join me in welcoming a return guest and someone who I consider a dear friend, John A. Skip Leitner. Skip is an international resource economist who leads a team of consultants, the Economic and Human Dimensions Research Associates based in Tucson, Arizona. He is the past president of the Association of Environmental Studies and Sciences, an independent interdisciplinary professional association in higher education. And it's really a big deal. Just trust me, just Google AESS. He is also a senior economic research fellow for Russia's largest university system, the Russian Presidential Academy of National Economy and Public Administration. Skip, someday we are going to go down the rabbit hole about that. And you can hate me, but I have to share with everyone one more scoop that I wanted to talk about on the last show, but I think it's even more relevant for this show than when I had you on first, because it speaks volumes about where you were at a time when many people, it might even be me included, could think maybe greenhouse gas was from something you ate. I mean, it's like not everybody was talking about greenhouse gases 20, 25, 30 years ago. So I decided to read it. In 1998, Skip was awarded the EPA's gold medal for his work with a team of economists to evaluate the impact of different strategies that might assist in the implementation of smart climate policies. And when I read that, I said, yes, Skip, I wonder how that's working for you now. In 2003, the U.S. Combined Heat and Power Association gave him an award to acknowledge his contributions to the policy development of that industry. In 2004, his paper, How Far Energy Efficiency? Catalyzed new research into the proper characterization of efficiency as a long-term resource. And, you know, Skip, I added those pieces kind of to highlight the good, the bad, and the ugly, how long you've been at it, how long some of your colleagues have been at it, and what an uphill battle we still have right now today, especially with the policies of the current administration. It's just been devastating. So let's get on to it. Here's what kind of blows my mind, because I did go back to look at the podcast we did in January, and I know that COVID-19 was like a little whisper, so it wasn't anywhere like it is today in May. But we kind of got down in the weeds then about looking at the United States economy from a true macro perspective. And clearly, in January, you said, you know, our economy is slipping out from under us, which it was, the real economy. That was then. And, you know, baby, look at us now. Even though we can honestly start anywhere you want, I'd like to go back to my intro and get your thoughts on why is everybody treating this so much in the immediate and disconnected moment more as a consumption problem, providing short-term money for people. And I don't want to sound like I'm some kind of shrew. You have to pay the rent, you have to eat. But there are things for businesses and people to be doing that would be simulating a lasting economy that would help build up our resilience for a sustainable capacity. Why are we not building our future? And by that, I mean a sustainable future that will make all the difference in the world for our collective future. Why aren't we doing that, Skip?
Well, you framed it very nicely at the beginning. We're so much in the moment, as you suggest. So taking care of our work, our home, our family, our communities, but disconnected from the larger things going on around us. So we're wholly unaware. We don't track the kind of information, not aware of all these things going on. And yet it's adding up slowly to an impact. And I recall a conversation I had with a physician up in Alaska. He and I were waiting for a flight down to Seattle 7 years ago. And he actually was a physician who was doing research into things like HIV and the viruses. And we talked for 40 minutes in the airport there. And he said to me, we are just not paying attention and providing the kind of support, the kind of research, the kind of capacity development to handle the oncoming diseases that we're likely to hit, because we are not paying attention to that as a possibility. And the same thing with climate. If I were to ask people how much we emit in the way of greenhouse gas emissions, carbon dioxide in particular, into the atmosphere, how much we've emitted since 1750 when we began collecting this data, we wouldn't have a clue. But I can tell you, rather than tell you how many tons we've emitted over there, if we're to add it all up, we have put into the atmosphere since the Industrial Revolution globally the equivalent of 13 trillion refrigerators. It doesn't take an atmospheric chemist to imagine that if that is stuff we've been putting into the atmosphere all these years, it's got to have an impact at some point. And that point is converging on us right now. In fact, I've talked to a number of scientists who tell me that the air pollution we've been putting in the air, the burning of fossil fuels when we drive our car or generate electricity, the coal, the natural gas, creating air pollution, which enhances things like the coronavirus. But as we've also been developing, putting streets in, new housing developments, new commercial buildings, new malls, we've been pushing the ecosystem really hard without being aware that it's creating more problems for things like the virus, and they're beginning to interact more closely with us because they had a barrier. They had their own system they were in and weren't being a problem to us. But as we keep pushing, that interaction is beginning to happen real time. We've had the MERS, we've had the SARS virus, we've had Ebola, and now we've got a coronavirus. We just haven't been investing in ways that make us better understand the impacts, and now we're beginning to see the price.
Yeah.
The good news is there are opportunities, but only if we begin acting quickly. Does that make sense?
You know, it makes so much sense. And when you were talking, and when I've thought about the conversations we've had, when we are growing up, most people are taught you should save money. You should have a retirement account. You should buy a house that lasts. You should buy a car that lasts. You should think not just about your thing today, but, you know, you don't want a house. It's not the three little pigs. You know, you want to build your house of brick, and we're not doing a very good job there. But I'm trying to get to the sense of there are parts of us with our human DNA and the way that we think that we realize that there are going to be days to come, and we prepare for it. But when it comes to what's going on with the impact of climate change, not what's coming, the cost of it already, let alone the dire predictions for this year alone in terms of drought and millions of people dying, how can we even get these conversations with the right questions and ignite some dynamic dialogue that gets us where we are in the moment?
Yeah, good question. Yeah.
Which is quick fixes.
Yes.
But you live it. You're doing it. You see the future. you guys have crystal balls because you know science and you know that this is what's happening. And, you know, to me, it goes back before the reality of what we're measuring. This is in everybody's best interest, because if you put a Band-Aid on a big festering sore without any antibiotics, the Band-Aid doesn't help. It blows up.
That's right.
And it's the same analogy. We're giving ourselves a false sense of security. And of course, let's not get started spending money on all the wrong things. But what do we, I live this so much that I get immersed in it. And it's like, why isn't everybody talking about this? Why doesn't everybody read what Skip's up to and Jim Beiser and Diana Liverman and Jonathan Overpeck and the list goes on? Why is it so hard for us?
Well, a really good...
And there's a big, bold question.
you got a week to talk about this, Gina?
I know. That's what happened. I said, before we went on air, it's like, let's make this the second part of a many-part series, because it is not an hour conversation.
Right.
But at least we can plant some seeds with our listeners and raise awareness, because the people listening to these podcasts, they care and they get it.
Well,
and they can change behaviors.
Yeah, you're asking a darn good question, critical question, important question. But let me take you back to the magic year in the U.S. economy, 1776, of course, our revolution.
Oh my God.
There was also a book written in 1776 by a guy named Adam Smith called The Wealth of Nations. And a lot of people consider him as a founding thinker of what we now call economics. But in 1776, as we thought about what the economy was, we just thought about the market, about people. We didn't have a reality check in terms of how the reality of the world, the climate, the soil, the moisture, the rain patterns, the wind patterns, the sun patterns. We had no clue about this. So we developed our thinking independently of that. 1776, we did not know things about energy until the 1800s. 1776, we did not know until Einstein wrote his famous treatise in 1905 that E actually does equal mc squared. And yet we continued on separating this idea of the market and the economy, keeping it far away from what we call the ecosystem, the earth, its resources, its a lively interaction, the different plants and animals that are out there. And we finally pushed hard enough that we're reaching a critical threshold where we've got to pay attention. Just as you said, we've been brought up to learn how to save money, hopefully, for our future, or to set aside a down payment for a home. But we have never figured out how to save and invest in the world around us, sometimes called the biosphere, sometimes
right.
Mother Nature, sometimes ecosystems. So that has been the big divide. But we're so caught up in the day-to-day. And I get it. And I remember raising my daughter, and I remember having to think about bills I needed to pay tomorrow and things like that. We're so caught up in that we're disconnected in that immediate moment, not able to see very far out into the future. But we now have the wherewithal, if we invest in the researchers, if we invest in the science, if we invest in the research and development, really can, that provides jobs on the one hand. But those jobs then begin to benefit us by helping create a path forward that synergizes both the earth and the economy together, a synergy that doesn't exist now. But that's what we've got to do. And you and I have talked about this. We've either got a hard decade, not just to think about it and begin to do it, but a hard decade to get things actually underway and accomplishing, or we're going to be faced with a very bad century of more hurricanes, wildfires, more viruses erupting from unknown places, because we're intruding further and further into where they live and where they succeed. So that dynamic has got to be shifted fairly quickly.
Which is really a perfect segue to when I was talking to Kelly about this show. And we're excited about this show because it's so topical right now, as it was 6 months ago, as it will be 12 months from now. And she said, Kelly said, when her son is ready to do some harder homework, he says, "Mom, I'm really getting ready to do the big brain stuff. That's what I have to do."
Ooh, and I like that.
I like that too. And, you know, Kelly said, why is it so hard for us? Why are we not willing to talk about the big brain stuff? you know, and this past 2 months is perfect examples. We're so caught up in our rights and our filters in the stories we tell ourselves about what the reality is. When I, you know, the dumbest thing I think someone can do is to get engaged on your Facebook page. And I do it. So like hashtag dumbass, right? But sometimes I just have to have an outlet, right? And I'm talking to the choir, yes, singing to the choir. And I see all my friends saying, you know, right on, right on. But when I went down the rabbit hole about the closing of the meat packing plants. So I'm not a vegetarian. I don't eat beef, but I could give up beef. Almost every friend I know that still does eat beef would be more than happy to give up beef if it meant that 100 people wouldn't die because they were at the meat packing plant. And look what happened, Skip. There were protests, yep, both people that saying, I don't want to go to work because I don't want to die. And then people showing up in our stupid capital with, oh my God, saying, I have a right to work. I have a right to work. Yes, you do. And what we're trying to do is give you a right to live and come together as a community to make it happen. But you live in another world. You do. You live with people that are thinking like you a lot. You're not out there trying to convince climate deniers because that is a big waste of time. But is part of what's wrong the way we continue to tell the story? Because people have to be able to hear it. And when I listen to you, I can hear it. And I listen and I want more. And we have a half hour conversation scheduled. And an hour and a half later, I'm saying, well, I took a lot of notes, Skip. We have to do another podcast. Is there more going on in your circles, your spheres of influence that are hopeful, where you see, you know, vast amounts of investments in renewable energy, for example? And I know that I used to cover things with vertical growing and aquaponics and, you know, different kinds of seeds that are native seeds. There is good news, but as a planet, it can't be just like little pockets. We kind of all have to be pulling this big rock up the same hill. So what's your balance to my, you know, is it all bad and why won't people listen?
Well, no, really good question. And you remind me, I'm working with two different groups of people, even as we speak right now. So while, yes, we're doing the best we can with the virus out in play at this point, a number of people are indeed looking ahead, and I'm working with a major innovator, a guy who's got a number of patents, runs some interesting businesses in California, and with some people separately on the East Coast, up in New York, up in Washington, D.C., elsewhere, and we're developing strategies, exactly as you're suggesting, how to begin thinking not just about spending money, but how to invest, and how to invest in people. Kelly's son is wanting to think big brain. Well, how can we provide the education, the interest, the opportunity for him to move in that direction? So investing in people on the one hand, new skills, jobs that have benefits for the larger economy, but then building up our infrastructure. You know, we still are living largely off of the 20th century infrastructure. We think about Facebook, we think about the social media. That's kind of on the fringe. We need to be integrating more of this kind of communication, this interaction, this network within the way we produce goods and services so that we can real-time meet the actual demand, meet it much more efficiently with a lot less waste, a lot less energy. That's got to become part of the 20th century, 21st century build-out of a positive infrastructure. So the good news is, we've got groups of people that I'm aware of. I spoke last night to people in India at a major university there. 11 o'clock my time last night, late morning their time today. And they had some really good questions, and they're interested, and they're doing it in a collaborative, not in a competitive way. So what I'm suggesting is, yes, there are people beginning to seriously explore, and I think you're going to see emerging some really smart plans moving forward. How to not just spend money, but how to invest in ourselves, how to invest in the environment, how to invest in a more productive economy that gets the job done. And as people learn about this, they darn well better start supporting some of these ideas because, yes, we are individuals, but at what we do as individuals has a huge impact on so many other things that, my gosh, when I was born, Gina, I don't want to tell how old you were, but when I was born, there was 2.5 billion people on this earth.
Right.
And there are now pushing 8 billion people on this earth.
Same earth.
And when I was born, we had a per capita income that's 1/4 of the global per capita income today. So we've increased the population 3 times. We've increased income by a factor of 4, 13 times bigger. But out of all of those years, adding up together since 1951, adding up all the consumption, all the materials we've produced, all the matter we've created, it's 350 times the size of 1950 globally. And we, out to the year 2050, it'll be 1,000 times the size of our 1950 economy. That is a physical consequence we can't ignore. That means people need to be aware of and awake and begin to support these new ideas that are going to come out. They're not politically left. They're not politically right. They are ideas that help us deal with the physical reality of climate change, of soil erosion, of fecal matter from our agricultural production with animals. We have like 80-some million cows and 60-some million pigs. A cow may put out 40 pounds of fecal matter a day or more. And we're just barely managing it. In fact, we don't manage it all that well. So all these things add up. And what I'm saying is, to answer your question, people are beginning to take this seriously, begin to develop smart plans. And then we, as a society, need to reach out and say, yes, gosh darn it, we got to support this. We've got to make sure that our legislators, our city council, our board of supervisors are paying attention and willing to make these kinds of investment because it has real benefits, real paybacks.
And you answered the question so well because, you know, I have two quick stories. One is, I think this is hysterical, but my husband's family owns some land on the way to, for us, between Deming, New Mexico and I-25 to go to Albuquerque, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it is not like any place you and I would really want to build a house on. Let's just say that his grandfather bought pieces of land out there, you know, almost 100 years ago, right?
Right.
Well, we got contacted by a solar company. And I read about them. They are big up-and-comers. And they are, we just signed a contract to lease, it was a lease purchase agreement, because they are going to put vast solar arrays on that property, which makes them really smart. It's about the only thing that land, it's so suited for it because the sun shines a lot and there's no trees for obstruction. So to me, that means there are people with vision and money that sees the future, and it's not in gas and oil, in my opinion.
That's right.
Then the other story,
and they're making it, and they're making it easy for us.
Yes.
They've got the ideas and the resources, but they're making it easy for us to do. We need more of that as well.
Yes, yes. So then this my newsletter article for next week. It's just such a victory, and I don't know if you read about it. It certainly didn't make the national news, which I wish it had. But a judge in Montana canceled 300 oil and gas leases. He canceled every single oil and gas lease in the state. I read volumes about the case. And basically what he said, I'm not going to fault the BLM on their research. And he was really funny. He said, because there was none. They just granted the leases. They pushed them through and they rushed them through. And, you know, I have my own commentary on what a kettle of fish. But what I wish people would understand when they see that, we weren't taking any money away from the gas and oil companies because it wasn't theirs to take. It was on national forest land and BLM land and near communities. And if you don't believe in the impact of fracking, I'm sorry for you. That's how I feel on the negative impact on the environment. And what I thought about it was, this is a victory for mankind, womankind, because that pollution is the air that we all exchange. So I want to get that judge on this show if he can talk about it and talk about how...
I think it's a good idea.
It's a big decision. But let's go back to the Okay, go ahead.
Here's the deal, is that when people say that the judge took away or canceled the 300 leases on BLM property, that doesn't mean the money's going away. It means the money's going to be shifted into something different. What people don't understand, as an economist, I have what we call the idea of opportunity cost. If I spend money over here, I may get so many jobs. But if I spend my money not there, but over here, I may get twice as many jobs.
Right.
And we don't think that way. So everybody's going to look at that BLM decision and say, oh my God, where are the jobs going to go? Well, if we have the opportunity to invest that same money elsewhere in the more productive use of energy or in wind power or solar,
yes,
what have you, converting light into electricity, it turns out we're likely going to get even more jobs than we would imagine. So it's not going to go away, but we've got to, as a society, get used to the idea that tax dollars or leases like that are not a negative thing. They are a positive thing if we redirect the flow, the
right,
talent, the skills in these new directions. And that's the task at hand.
And how much money Montana makes from hunting and fishing, which I'm totally in favor of,
yeah,
except for
yeah,
maybe some of their policies on wolves from time to time. But it is an economy. It is a tourist economy that impacts them so positively. And if you destroy that, all those dollars will go away also, because
right,
ecotourism or just hunting and fishing. So let's really get down a little bit more, because I think it's, you know, in, I was a big Game of Thrones geek. I was. I
Ooh.
Was late to the party, but it is such a metaphor to me for what you talk about. Are we building capacity for a hard decade or a bad century? When you said that to me, I got chills. And I have a one-year-old granddaughter, so I'm really interested in the hard decade for a good century.
Right.
You know what I mean? I'm ready to do the hard decade thing if I know that in, you know, 10 years, Rooney has a chance for a better future. So tell us a little bit more about those scenarios and how the lack of capacity building, it will weaken our resistance. It will weaken our economy. It will weaken our social well-being.
That's right.
It's just, we're so in the moment. So what's going on in that conversation?
Yeah, it'd be great if we had a dashboard where we could see how the economy looked in, say, 1950, 1970, 1990, and today, and could immediately understand the dynamics. But I've done some things like build what I call my Truman to Trump chart. Forgive me for putting it in presidential terms.
It's okay.
But in 1949, looking at the administration of President Truman, all the way through Nixon, all the way through Clinton, all the way through the Bush administrations, the Obama administration, I found a couple interesting things. One is that it turns out, and I'm not giving credit or detracting from, but during the presidential terms that have been under the Dems, economic activity per capita GDP, growth in per capita income, if you will, grew over that period to today, about 2.6% a year. Under the GOP, only 1.6% a year. In other words, our economy has done, actually, if we step back and look, instead of getting caught up so much in the moment, my rights to be in this building or my right to have a job, but step back and look, we've actually done better under the Democrats. And I am not saying that as a political basis, but letting the evidence speak for itself. That's point number one. Point number two is, under all administrations, whether Democratic or Republican, under all administrations, that per capita income has slowly deteriorated. We're still growing, but weaker and weaker. So instead of 2.6% in the 50s and 60s after World War II, we're now getting down to 1% a year. And that means we're going to have an even weaker economy if we have less income in the way of taxes, less business activity, less investment happening. We've got more people coming in, more expectations, and we're still continuing to do damage to the climate, to our water systems, to the soil. So it's going to come back to haunt us. But if we step back and say, my gosh, instead of spending money over here, I can direct my effort over there. Instead of using electricity from coal, I can have electricity because businesses are now making it easy to lease from them instead of me having to buy it. So I save money right away and we make that transition easy. So people are going to have to be a little bit more awake, a little bit more aware, and encourage that kind of transition, even as then you and I know we're doing this, I've got nothing but LEDs in my home, light emitting diodes. Instead of a 60 or 100 watt bulb, I've got a 4 to 6 watt bulb that gives out just as much light. So as consumers, there are a lot of simple steps we can take. But as consumers, we need to more proactively as a community, say to the city council, say to the board of supervisors, say to the legislature, you need to help us take these actions. You need to help us redirect effort over here. And that's the only way we can move forward. We don't have a lot of time to debate it. We've got to get moving and actually get things done in the next 10 years.
And the sad thing is, COVID-19 showed us a lot of really positive impacts from not driving.
Yeah.
From not filling the not flying as much, from not traveling as much. And, you know, when you're talking, I start thinking about things, excuse me, like, so you mentioned shopping malls, which already around the country are tombs. They are tombs.
Yes.
They are being vacated at light speed. Is there, and I think about, what are we going to do? What are we going to do with them? I hate the mall. I used to live in the mall when I had two little kids. We had fun.
Yeah.
We would just, I'd take the stroller and blah, 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 and we'd go to all these crappy stores. And I learned more. I got woke, as some of the younger kids say.
Yeah.
And I wonder about, in your world, in all of the points that you touch, do you think we'll see things like we'll turn them into housing units, places where university students can live, so that it's not like tearing them down, but we're going to have to think about reuse, not just reduce, but reuse and recycle.
That's right.
And there's so much real estate. Even last night on several of the news stations, because I was hopping around, they're talking about the long-term impact on real estate. And one big company, Twitter, okay, came out yesterday and said, we don't need a building ever again. It's really working for us that all of our employees work from home.
Yes.
Which, you know, to me, that's not the ultimate sweet spot, because some of my best friends I met at work.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
So it's a new like vision of the world. But real estate, and the thing that you make me think about, and I feel like I've like gone off the radar here for a minute, but is the ripple effect, the ripple effect, the ripple effect, the ripple effect. It's not going to be like a volcano that erupts and then it stops. It's going to keep erupting and there's going to be more ripples. And one of those is real estate. People aren't going to have to go to work a lot. And I find I'm very satisfied these days with Zoom calls. So I'm not going to drive downtown 3 times in one day, which is a total of 3 hours of my time.
Yes.
For meetings.
Yes.
Which I try to not do. But then, Skip, I think about every time I go, I get a snack, I get a drink, I get something that's contributing to the economy. So there's another spin. So I just, you know, when you talk about a bad century or a hard decade, those things are just going to keep unraveling.
Yeah.
Agreed?
Yeah, agreed. And let me bring you this story. Maybe people in the Arizona area, Tucson, may have heard of what we call, I don't want to advertise, but the Bisbee Breakfast Club.
Yes.
Over on Sunrise and Swan, there is what's called the Bisbee Breakfast Club. What I like about that, not only do they cook some pretty good food for breakfast, but they took an existing gasoline station,
right,
and made it into a restaurant.
That's such a cool place. Yes,
it is.
It is.
They repurposed the facility. I was in the Netherlands, and some years ago, a shipbuilding company went under, and the docks were left vacant. But a few years later, they repurposed that whole shoreline and dock and created a whole new school of information technology where they're teaching people how to use new skills that used to be a shipbuilding place, but now it is an education place. And one of the fun things they've done, for example, some students, now entrepreneurs, learned how to use internet and hydrology to create, as when you're in the water, all right, and Netherlands, of course, has a lot of water around it. So you transfer goods from a ship to a shore or a ship to a bridge, and you need a stable platform to wheel whatever is onto or off the ships or onto whatever pier. They've created a device where real time it reads the waves. They have hydraulic arms that can float up and down. So the water is going up and down, even as the bridge stays stable, because they've learned how to use mechanics, engineering, information technology, sensors, that these hydraulic arms go up and down in fluctuation with the actual water levels, but the bridge itself stays very stable. That used to be an old shipbuilding facility. Now it is an enterprise entrepreneurial development facility. So just like the Bisbee Breakfast Club being repurposed, we need to think about, as you say, shopping malls could become homes for new people with a reasonably straightforward reconstruction. But then we have to repurpose not only buildings, but people.
Yes.
And
yes.
You don't know this, but I used to be a meatpacking worker in my youth. I used to work hog kill in Iowa.
Oh, my.
My job was to pull guts.
Skip.
And I can tell you how closely people were working together.
Oh.
And what kind of, but now I got the benefit to step out of that and move on to other things. I had opportunity that a lot of people weren't given. In a similar way, we've got to help the coal miners, the electricians move out. I'll tell you one final story. In San Diego, there is a fabulous facility, a building that is owned by management and labor together. It is an electrician's building where they have a 4-year apprenticeship program for people to learn new skills in electronics. It's owned by the National Electrical Contractors Association, San Diego County. That's the management. It's owned by the IBEW, International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. That's labor. They own it together. They developed a course curriculum together. They pull people into apprenticeships, train them. And on this building, they have a 90-kilowatt photovoltaic system, a very big
wow.
system to generate electricity for the facility.
Wow.
So it generates electricity, and it becomes the means to help train these emerging electricians on how to care and maintain these kind of renewable energy systems. It's more that kind of interactive, collaborative effort that we absolutely need, repurposing, collaborating, building out new, integrating ideas that make sense for a lot more people than we typically imagine.
And get ready for, don't be afraid of the big brain stuff. You know, I used to get so intimidated by guests like you, and because I didn't know what you knew. And then at some point, I think it was like after I interviewed Jane Goodall, it's not my job to know as much as Jane Goodall. Because she studied for years and years and years. It was her life. What my job is to...
Well, I can tell you, it's not my job to know what Jane Goodall knows, because she knows a heck of a lot more than I do.
No, that's right. It's like I was beating myself up. And what my job is to respect the guests enough to know the background, the content, what the message is, and to be able to keep the dialogue going. So it came from something I was so intimidated by, because I changed careers at 57, for God's sake.
Oh, my goodness.
But to be able to be that sponge and to be the expert in asking really good questions is what my goal is for every show.
Mm.
So two more things. One is, do you want to tell us a little bit about the book? There's a book in the future. Do you want to say anything about that now, or is that episode 3 with Skip?
Well, it's underway. Yeah, I'm writing a book in the middle of developing the research for it now, called Build Back Better. Actually, very consistent with what you and I are talking about. Build Back Better, Rethinking Energy, the Economy, and Governance. This gets back to the idea that our idea of the economy was so outdated, because when we began developing a lot of our philosophy and our thinking about the economy in the 1700s, we didn't know about ecosystems. We didn't know about climate.
Right.
We didn't know about atmosphere. But now that we understand the physical reality, we've got to reintegrate biological sciences with economic sciences and social sciences to do a better job of helping people understand the huge opportunities if we make smarter choices. So Rethinking Energy, the Economy, and Governance. And here's the thing about governance. So many people today, it's kind of sad, think of government as a means to crack down on people's individual rights and liberties. And I can see how they might think that. Or they think about government as the means to tax you to death. But what the word government stems from the Greek word meaning to navigate or steer. So the question is, how are we going to, as a society, navigate into the future in a way that we have more winners, not just including society, but the environment and the climate together? So how to reimagine incentives, how to reimagine collaboration, how to reimagine Kelly's son thinking big, using his brain big time.
Right, big brain.
How can we imagine to move that? So this is the idea of the book. Coming forward with ways to build back better and rethinking governance is going to be a critical piece of that if we're going to succeed.
Well, I've certainly given you enough evidence to know that I mean it when I say I cannot wait to read it. I know you'll be back on the show. And I kind of want to leave with something, and you can chime in. You know, I make this big joke, and it's kind of a joke and kind of not, about me getting the last word. And to me, the last word about this is, I would love our listeners to learn more about you, about your work. I'd love them to use their big brain to think about the integration of climate change, climate science, climate adaptation and mitigation with an economic lens. Think about what it means to build a future, just build a future, period,
right,
that is sustainable and socially just. So I want to make that an invitation. And then I'm going to try to remember every show, because you alluded to it, but let's call it. Vote, vote, frickin' vote. And not just for president, people,
right,
for Senate, for House of Representatives, for Board of Supervisors, for the mayor, for any type of social justice policies, criminal justice reform, whatever it is you believe in, even if you don't believe in it like I believe in it, even though I know I'm right, kind of kidding.
Yeah.
There's never been a time, if you care about climate, ask every god darn candidate, what's your climate policy? What's your climate action policy? Not what you think about climate change. I mean, God help us.
Yeah.
But what is your plan? Because one thing I know innate in all of us is survival. And that's what we're talking about. If we put it in the sense of survival, and you've made my life better. You've made my life richer. You've made my life broader, because you've stretched the way that I think. And the silo effect is what has hurt to me the climate movement. It's like it's either about solar, or it's about water, or it's about building. And the climate is about the climate. And you have touched so many points in my life about what I need to do to show up every day to make a difference. So that's my last word, but you can say anything else you want. I'm letting you have the last word. Don't tell anybody.
You are being very gracious, but you're asking darn good questions that we need all of us to wrestle with. So thank you so much for that opportunity.
Skip, you just rock. And I can't wait till we can actually see each other again. But I know that we'll be talking. And when your book is ready, we'll be ready to do another interview, especially if I get an advanced copy signed by the author. So there you have it. Okay.
Fair enough. Thank you.
I also invite people to look at Skip's, to listen to Skip's last interview in January. And I hope that we can, I say, SEO the heck out of this, because I think these are the kinds of podcasts that people really want to be listening to. It's big brain stuff, and they want to use their big brain. They just need to be guided like I do. So thanks for showing up in my world. And I always end with thanking you, the listeners, because without you, there would be no us. So thank you, Skip Leitner, and thank you, Mrs. Green's World Tribe.